Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a look at the much-anticipated Republican U.S. presidential candidates debate. We'll hear about the clearing of the way for the International Syria Support Group. We get a sampling of what can be found in the new almanac. And we'll hear from our music man about a young success in the biz.
He attracts all ages because he's the kind of kid that, you know, moms love, and the young 12-year-olds, tweens, they love him as well. And he's an it guy right now.
It's right here on The Voice of America. Nine leading Republican U.S. presidential contenders clashed over national security issues in their much-anticipated debate late Tuesday in Las Vegas, Nevada. And watching the event was our national correspondent, Jim Malone, who joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
Well, it's the day after. What is the reaction to the show?
I think the big takeaway is kind of what you just mentioned, that the focus of this campaign has very sharply turned toward threat of terrorism, national security, how to confront Islamic State. And that's certainly where much of the action was in the Las Vegas debate. Various contenders made their pitches. Was there an overall winner? Not to my mind, per se, but we did see some conflicts arise, notably between Donald Trump, the front runner, who took some flack from Jeb Bush, who's been lagging in the polls. And the other conflict that seems to be emerging now is between two of the senators, Ted Cruz, who's doing well in the polls behind Trump, and Marco Rubio, Florida. They're kind of competing for similar constituencies. And the basis of their argument is who's tougher on national security. And they went through a variety of different debates on that issue.
I was going to ask you specifically if you could just do a couple of the candidates, Trump and a few others, on what would they do about ISIS?
Well, obviously, most of them are talking very tough about it. Let's take the case of Ted Cruz. He wants to focus on the use of air power. He likes to invoke the term carpet bombing. But Marco Rubio challenged him on that, said, you know, air power alone is not enough. We're going to have to send some ground troops in. Rubio, like Ohio Governor John Kasich, though, wants to focus on a sort of coalition in the Middle East to go after ISIS on the ground, if you will. A number of other contenders, though, see other sort of issues in dealing with ISIS that involve a bolder U.S. leadership role. Chris Christie talked about this, the governor of New Jersey, and Jeb Bush said that based on his experience, he would be the better commander-in-chief. And in fact, at one point, he challenged Donald Trump about who would be the stronger leader.
Another thing that was an issue for the night was immigration, especially in light of Donald Trump's remarks about Muslims barring them.
Yeah, that's right. And that was challenged right out of the gate in the debate by Jeb Bush, who said it's the wrong approach. It wouldn't work and would be a major deterrent for Arab allies in the Middle East to side with the U.S. to go after radical jihadists. So this became a bit of a flashpoint. But again, Trump stood by his proposal, saying it's not about picking on a religion. It's not about isolating the United States from threats per se. He said it's about security and that we need to do a stronger job of vetting people coming into the country. And he would support a temporary ban on non-American Muslims.
Well, as you know, Jim, it's less than 2 months before the Iowa caucuses. That's the first nominating event of the primary election season. Do you think anyone is going to throw in the towel before then?
Good question. We had nine people on stage in the main debate. A lot of the criticism, even the day after, has been we still have too many contenders. But here's the problem. Because of the uncertainty in the race, though Trump is leading, he's surging nationally, a lot of the rivals think at some point he may not make it. They want to hang in as long as possible, feeling that they might have a chance if something were to happen to his candidacy. But the other one to watch, of course, is Ted Cruz, who's surging in the early voting state of Iowa. He hopes to use that as a springboard. And some of the other rivals, again, think Cruz is vulnerable as a national candidate. So they're hanging in for now, and no sign of anybody leaving the race quite yet.
Well, thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you.
This debate is getting a great deal of response on the web, as we would expect. And joining me with details is social media reporter Olin Akeshoglu. Welcome, Olin.
Hi, Susan. Well, that's exactly right. The GOP debates continue to generate a lot of buzz on social media. Facebook activated a running poll for the GOP debate, updated in real time, where users could express how they felt watching the debate by clicking on a set of 5 emojis. They could choose from excited, impressed, neutral, disappointed, and angry. I was monitoring the poll throughout the second half of the debate, and angry consistently was the most popular response, going as high as 50% of respondents at certain points.
Well, which candidates and at what moments got the most attention?
Twitter's government and elections team was active throughout the night, tweeting out statistics using the handle @gov. According to the team's tweets, Donald Trump dominated the discourse on the Twitter sphere, occupying 35% of the hashtag GOP debate conversation. After him came Bush at 13%, Cruz at 11%, and then Rubio and Carson tied at 9%. Donald Trump also had the top 3 most tweeted moments during the debate. The top moment was Trump sarcastically telling Bush, "You're a tough guy, Jeb, I know." Another interesting statistic the team tweeted was which candidates had the largest follower growth during the debate. And surprisingly, Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders, who wasn't even in the debate, he brought in the most new followers. Trump came in second place.
Any other interesting trends come out of the debate?
Yes, another big trend actually came during one of the commercial breaks. CNN aired a teaser for the new season of the popular Netflix political drama House of Cards, featuring the main character Frank Underwood in a mock political ad for a new presidential term. That got a lot of people excited for the new season and drew a few comparisons of the Republican candidates to President Frank Underwood. A few people actually saying they would prefer Underwood to the current GOP field.
Okay, well, thanks, Olin.
You bet, Susan.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A team of researchers from the University of Michigan has built a prototype of a new lie detector with unique lie-detecting software based on real-world data. The team used a set of 120 video clips taken from media coverage of actual trials to develop the software. The University of Michigan's team prototype lie detector examines a subject's words and gestures. And unlike a traditional polygraph that requires a number of physical connection to the person being questioned, the prototype doesn't need to touch the subject in order to work. The researchers say their new software allows them to identify several tells or clues that the people are lying. The developers say they were able to correctly identify people who were being deceptive as much as 75% of the time. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The way is now clear for the International Syria Support Group to meet at the United Nations in New York Friday, following agreement in Moscow between the United States and Russia, in meetings Tuesday between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, President Vladimir Putin, and his Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins me here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, this third round of talks Friday could result in a draft U.N. Security Council resolution on a Syrian transition process aimed at ending the nearly 5-year conflict. Differences remain between Washington and Moscow over the fate of President Bashar al-Assad, a Russian ally. But Mr. Kerry said the focus is no longer on those differences.
The United States and our partners are not seeking so-called regime change, as it is known, in Syria. What we have said is that we don't believe that Assad himself has the ability to be able to lead the future Syria, but we focus today not on our differences about what can or can be done immediately about Assad. We focused on a process, on the political process, whereby Syrians will be making decisions for the future of Syria. But we do believe that nobody should be forced to choose between a dictator and being plagued by terrorists.
Another difference between the U.S. and Russian position centers on which opposition groups to allow to take part in the transition process. Both countries hope talks between the opposition and Damascus can begin early in the new year. David Lesh, a Syrian analyst at Trinity University in Texas, told me Mr. Kerry's remarks reflect an evolution in U.S.-Syria policy that now recognizes Mr. Assad cannot be removed short of a major military intervention that would involve U.S. forces.
They've come to realize in the interim over the last few years, especially with Iran and Russia emphatically wanting to keep Bashar al-Assad in power, that they can't do anything short of boots on the ground to remove Bashar al-Assad. So I think the administration has reluctantly come to accept that Bashar al-Assad will stay in power for some amount of time during some sort of transition process as preordained by the 2012 Geneva Communique, which is still the popular framework for political resolution to the Syrian conflict.
What does it all mean for this pending Friday meeting of the International Syria Support Group in New York?
It means that there's a lot of negotiating to happen. I think all parties recognize that there must be a negotiated settlement to end the war or de-escalate the war before concentrating on the bigger threat that certainly the regional international parties and certainly the United States feel in terms of the Islamic State. The decision that they have made is that in order to have a negotiated settlement of any sort, they have to put off the disposition of the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, till a later date. Therefore, that will not be an obstacle to even engaging in negotiations that may lead to a political settlement. Now all parties are aboard on that. Saudi Arabia, Turkey, of course, have been committed to removing Assad before rather than during or after a transition process. Many of the Syrian opposition parties are adamantly opposed to Bashar al-Assad continuing in power for any length of time. So this is something that has to be negotiated.
Well, Mr. Kerry did say of the Syrian opposition's position that the fact that Mr. Assad must leave as soon as peace talks begin is a non-starting position.
Because the government of Bashar al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad himself will not engage in a process of negotiation that puts him out of business. They see themselves continuing the long term. There has to be some sort of formula whereby the government of Syria and Bashar al-Assad believes that they have enough authority to continue on. At the same time, that a critical mass of the Syrian opposition believes that they've been empowered in terms of municipal or provincial autonomy.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, thumbing through this year's World Almanac, and we'll have a taste of One Call Away, a new music single. The World Almanac and Book of Facts 2016 is out, and joining us to talk about what is in this edition is Senior Editor Sarah Jansen. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Hey, maybe you might start off by sharing with our listeners just what the World Almanac is all about.
Well, the World Almanac has been around since 1868, so we've actually changed a lot over the course of our nearly 150-year history. But basically what we're about these days is providing your best go-to reference source for any question you might have, whether it's on politics or pop culture or science or sports, we've got you covered.
It's a reference book, basically.
Basically.
What are some of the major events of 2015?
Well, I think it would be no surprise to find out that our top news topic in 2015 was the ongoing civil war and conflict with ISIS in Iraq and Syria, obviously something that's going to be spilling into 2016. And then that's related to our number two top news topic, which was the refugee crisis. Almost a million refugees and migrants have reached Europe by boat or by sea in 2015, which is an enormous number. And that's, again, going to be something that we're going to be looking at in 2016 as well.
What about from the world of entertainment?
A lot happened in entertainment this year. Obviously, you saw the Star Wars premiere. That'll be interesting to see how that does numbers-wise as it tries to take down Avatar as the number one top-grossing film of all time. Adele's first record in a long time came out. You also saw the transition in Late Night with Stephen Colbert taking over for David Letterman. So a lot happened in 2015, for sure.
And what about sports?
Oh, gosh, it was a busy year in sports, too. I think one of the highlights for us was watching the U.S. women's national team take the World Cup this summer, the highest-rated World Cup of all time, which was really fun. You also saw the first Triple Crown winner in almost 40 years in American Pharoah. you had Deflategate distracting everyone all year, Serena Williams trying to do that calendar Grand Slam, a lot of interesting events in sports this year.
And you haven't mentioned politics.
Well, we were paying attention to politics all year. Maybe everyone's a little bit tired of hearing about it, but we do have a really great election preview that includes things like primary dates, debate dates, also an overview of what's going on in the election, including financial information about all those many, many, many different campaigns, including information on how the super PACs are doing, since that's how a lot of campaigns are being funded these days.
Now, you have things organized a little differently this year. Please tell us when we go out and buy one of your almanacs, how do we go about researching it?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking to answer a specific question, it's the same as any other reference book. You can use the table of contents or the index. But I think a lot of people like to just flip through it and land on a page. And really, if you're a generally curious person, you might just find something that you would have no interest in necessarily looking up yourself, but you kind of you get hooked by the new information, by the fun that's available in the World Almanac.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
There is a new symbol of a little salt shaker appearing on menus in chain restaurants in New York City. The image is on any menu item containing more than 2,300 milligrams of sodium, or about a teaspoon of salt, the recommended daily limit for individuals. New Yorkers consume considerably more than that on average. Specialist Dr. Howard Weintraub says excess salt intake is a factor in cardiovascular disease.
Elevated blood pressure and the sodium work alone and together to create vascular damage.
New Yorkers like Paul Fichter mostly agree the new salt emblem is a positive addition to chain menus.
It's good that people know that, hey, there's a little more sodium than, you know, your daily recommended value in something that you're eating, especially when you're eating out.
Cardiovascular disease was the leading cause of death in New York City in 2013, claiming nearly 17,000 lives. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
It's time to dive into the world of music, and our lifeguard is Border Crossing's host, Larry London, who's right here in the studio with me. Welcome, Larry.
Ooh, I like that. You must have been working hard on that opening.
Thank you. And today we're going to talk about a 24-year-old newcomer, I understand.
Yes, he is one of the hotter names in music today, and there's good reason for it. I met him last night, as a matter of fact, during a big show in Washington, D.C. he's a part of. But his name is Charlie Puth. Nominated for 3 Grammy Awards for his debut effort, and also a Golden Globe, which is in the Best Original Film Song category, for a song called See You Again, which features Wiz Khalifa and is in the film Furious 7, and gained Charlie Puth an awful lot of attention this past year. So now he's got his new album coming out, his debut album, which is 9-track Mind. It comes out in January. And he's already had 2 singles off the album. Today we're going to hear the second single.
That's One Call Away?
Yeah, One Call Away.
Call me, baby, if you need a friend. I just want to give you love. Come on, come on, come on. Reaching out to you, so take a chance. No matter where you go, I know you're not alone. I'm only one.
The first song was Marvin Gaye, and it's a song that he recorded with Meghan Trainor, and the song did very well for him. Now, he's only 24, but yet he told me that he's been influenced by a lot of old R&B music, and he said, interestingly enough, that when he was in high school, not too long ago, he never went out on a date, never left his house.
Oh, that's kind of sad.
Every mom's dream. He just stayed at home. Did his homework, and then would shut his door and would start writing music. Huh. He's always loved music, writing music, creating music on his computer in his bedroom. In fact, he said it's very ironic that it was 1 year ago, this January, he signed his record contract, his very first record contract. If you went back a year ago, he was writing the song Marvin Gaye in his bedroom. So he said it's kind of odd how it's all come together, and now the new song is out, and it's doing well for him also.
Well, what kind of crowd does he attract?
he attracts all ages because he's the kind of kid that, you know, moms love, and the young 12-year-olds, tweens, they love him as well. And he's an it guy right now. As I say, he gained a lot of attention and popularity for See You Again, which features a very famous rap hip-hop star, Wiz Khalifa. And so he's been writing music for a lot of people, and there's a lot of buzz about his upcoming debut album, Nine Track Mind.
I was going to ask, what was your impression? I mean, you got to speak with him. What did you think he was like?
He was nice. He was friendly, talkative, a little nerdy. But that's okay. I mean, you know, he was very, very nice guy. And you know, he deserves all the attention and success he's getting. In fact, he admitted he cried when he heard that he was nominated for 3 Grammys. He never expected that. But he said he got off an airplane, and his phone immediately, the text started coming in. 100 texts, everything was urgent, 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 mm-hmm. urgent. And he thought, oh, my God, something happened to somebody. And then when he read further, he found out it was him.
He found out it
happened to him, and he was taken by it. He was moved.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Larry.
And thank you very much, too. Oh, and by the way, he's got a new song also coming out with Selena Gomez. Just thought I'd throw that in as well.
Thanks.
One Call Away is the latest song from Charlie Puth.
The 2016 VOA calendar is ready for you. Just send your snail mail address by email to calendar@voanews.com. See you tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has continued to support the peaceful management and resolution of territorial and maritime disputes in the South China Sea. U.S. President Barack Obama reiterated this message during recent meetings in Southeast Asia, where he called for a halt to recent construction on disputed islands and submerged features in the South China Sea. We agree on the need for bold steps to lower tensions, including pledging to halt further reclamation, new construction, and militarization of disputed areas in the South China Sea, he said. China, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, Brunei, and Taiwan all claim sovereignty over some or all of the land features in the South China Sea. However, since 2014, China has engaged in land reclamation on 7 features in the Spratly Islands, where the Philippines and several other countries also have claims. The Philippines has recently brought elements of its dispute with China under the Law of the Sea Convention to an arbitral tribunal in The Hague. While the U.S. does not take a position on the territorial claims of each nation, it insists that all claims be based on international law and that differences be addressed peacefully through diplomatic and legal means. That's why, said President Obama, the United States supports the Philippines' decision to use arbitration under the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea to peacefully and lawfully address differences. The South China Sea is home to many valuable resources, including an important fishing industry. Vital shipping lanes traverse the area, carrying over half the world's merchant shipping tonnage. The U.S. insists that behavior by all countries uphold the principles of freedom of navigation and overflight, unimpeded lawful commerce, respect for international law, and the peaceful resolution of disputes.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.